I'll be reading from Matthew 5, 21 through 37. You have heard that it was said to those who lived long ago, "Don't commit murder," and all who commit murder will be in danger of judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with their brother or sister will be in danger of judgment. If they say to their brother or sister, "You idiot," they will be in danger of being condemned by the governing council. And if they say, "You fool," they will be in danger of fiery hell. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift at the altar and go. First, make things right with your brother or sister, then come back and offer your gift. Be sure to make friends quickly with your opponents while you are with them on the way to court. Otherwise, they will haul you before the judge. The judge will turn you over to the officer of the court, and you'll be thrown into prison. I say to you in all seriousness that you won't get out of there until you've paid the very last penny. You have heard that it was said, "Don't commit adultery." But I say to you that every man who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery in his heart. And if your right eye causes you to fall into sin, tear it out and throw it away. It's better that you lose a part of your body than the whole body be thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to fall into sin, chop it off and throw it away. It's better that you lose part of your body than the whole body go into hell. It was said, "Whoever divorces his wife must give her a divorce certificate." But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife except for sexual unfaithfulness forces her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have heard that it was said to those who lived long ago, "Don't make a false solemn pledge, but you should follow through on what you have pledged to the Lord." But I say to you that you must not pledge at all. You must not pledge by heaven, because it's God's throne. You must not pledge by earth, because it's God's footstool. You must not pledge by Jerusalem, because it's the city of the great king. And you must not pledge by your head, because you can't turn one hair white or black. Let your yes mean yes and your no mean no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one.
Thank you, Emma. And you might, if you want to have, if you have your Bible, you might turn to Matthew chapter 5. And that's where we will be together this morning. Everybody doing good today? Okay. Tell your faces you're okay. Yeah, all right. All right. Would you pray with me? Holy One, daily we face being shamed, canceled, and judged for not meeting expectations. Some of us even battle self-condemnation for failing to live up to our own goals. The ensuing loneliness leaves us weary when told our righteousness must exceed the religious elite. Thank you for both reaching the bar set for us and indwelling us, forming us into a community where our lives point to the one who is our righteousness, and all God's people say. If you receive our weekly email, then you may have read about my first experience at auction. A few years ago, when I was in the fifth grade, our principal took a small group to the stockyards. I cannot recall how I got selected to be part of that group, but nonetheless was, and Mr. Bloomer took us to the stockyards, and I mean, long before I knew that it was the smell of money, my nose knew right where it was. We lived not far, and so in the spring and fall, we would open up the house hoping for the breezes to cool off the house. Oh, could we smell it? In those days, I went to Lincoln Fifth Year Center. Now, for those of you who don't know what a fifth year center, it's like a 45 RPM record. It lasted for a little while and then no more. These fifth year centers were really part of a model to desegregate Oklahoma public schools in the early 1970s. And in fact, frankly, if we were being honest, some of you are here because of Judge Bohannon's decision. Yeah. You left Oklahoma City because, well, anyway, that's how urban sprawl started in the outside the Oklahoma metro. Mr. Bloomer took us to the auction that day. I remember it. It was probably a cloudy day, and we went into that ring. I don't know if it's still the same as it was, but I remember it. It kind of a stadium-style seating. We went in. It wasn't full that day, but there were a number of buyers, and we found our place seated several rows up, and you could see the auctioneer and the staff, and the corrals were there, and you heard the announcement as to how old the calves were, how much they weighed, and then the bidding began. And there I am in the fifth grade, and I'm watching these older men, and I can't see anybody moving, but they keep talking like someone's bidding higher and higher. So I catch what's happening. Someone's nodding, not wanting another person to know they're nodding. Or they tip their hat, or they kind of just move motion with their hand. And that way the auctioneer knows that someone has made the next highest bid. Well, I thought, I wonder what that's like. You've already guessed. That's right. So I decided as the next amount was announced, I just kind of flashed my hand. The auctioneer responded quickly, noticing. I mean, how was I to know he'd really think a student in the fifth grade was actually going to be bidding on livestock? The look on Mr. Bloomer's face. I mean, I couldn't decide if he was more surprised that I did that or shocked that the auctioneer's staff would actually receive my motion as a bid. You should know that at that moment, Mr. Bloomer helped me understand the meaning of don't move. Now, many of you have attended the Tuttle Fair Board's cake auction after the Tuttle Fair every August. And it's not uncommon for some friends of someone who they know is bidding on a cake to kind of find another place in the stadium over there to bid. You can watch what happens is someone over here on the, say, the north side of the stands is bidding. They want that cake. Maybe it's their daughter or their granddaughter's or grandson or their wife or somebody they know, and they want to bid on that cake. They've let 100 others pass, but they want that cake. And someone who's their friend is on the south side of the stadium, and it starts, the bidding begins. The four guys stand there on the ground looking up, waiting, looking for that nod, looking for the hand or some other gesture that indicates that someone wants to make a bid. Pretty soon, you can watch the rubbernecking going on when the person who wants to buy that cake had an amount they planned. And the amount just keeps rising because someone on the other end of the stadium is bidding. Look around, who is that? And there's a few chuckles in this group and a few chuckles in that group because they found out that I'm bidding Nathan up. And up the price goes. Making the cake more expensive. The church at Antioch heard the Sermon on the Mount. And as they were helped to connect the dots by the person who delivered the gospel, that's how it happened, by the way. They didn't have Mardell's to go get their own copy so that when the pastor stood and said, "Open your Bibles," there was one. It traveled around and the reader read, and it wasn't just the reader who read, but the reader who brought the gospel also provided the commentary, the explanation, helped connect the dots as to what was going on. And so as that church in Antioch got a copy, read to them of Matthew's gospel, the person was helping them connect the dots. And I wonder if when they got to this part of reading the sermon, this particular place, how those who were hearing this description of God's kingdom, this kingdom that Jesus was bringing into reality, exposing the people to its character and its actions that Those who participate in ought to live out. I wonder if when they got to this passage, the one that Emma read, I wonder, did they all of a sudden feel like, ooh, something changed? Someone is bidding up the law a little bit more. Someone's setting the bar a little bit higher. I mean, listen, it's impossible for you to read this passage and beyond verse 37 to, oh, just a few verses more, where six times, I believe it is, Jesus says something like, you've heard it said, but I say to you. Jesus is bidding up. Jesus is driving up the price. Jesus is setting the bar higher. And I just wonder if those who were hearing this message, this sermon repeated in the first century, if they too, like you and me, hear these words and go, whoa, I just like the part about not killing people. This stuff about getting angry, like that's impossible. You really think that I can not get angry? You really, really are asking me never to call anyone by a name? You mean I can't say you moron? Yeah. Don't you? I mean, don't you wonder? I mean, here it is. They had grown up saddled with a certain understanding of God's requirements in the law. They knew them, at least 10 of them. And here Jesus takes those laws, some from the 10 and some from the Torah, the expansion of those laws. And he says, you've been living your whole life thinking this is really the pattern that you need to live up to. But I want you to know, you got to actually work a little harder. Be a little better. Perform a little more. Is that how you hear it? I mean, at first glance, that's how I hear it. In fact, I'm not sure. In fact, I would actually go out on a limb and say that's exactly how Jesus wants you to hear it. I think that Jesus wanted the listeners then and wants us today to hear that if we think that we can decide what the 10 things are that we're going to do, and so long as we do those, we're all good to God, where we think that we're a little bit better than others because we can check them off. We've not killed anybody, we've not stolen, and we've not coveted, and we've not committed adultery, and we can check them off. And we can manage those. And then Jesus, if he's not the biggest meddler, says, oh, you think you got this figured out. Because really what you've decided is you know how to manage. You know how to perform well. And if we are honest, some of us grew up in an environment where what we learned about Christianity was is we needed to learn how to behave better. We need to make sure that we actually keep these things because then we can feel like we're acceptable to God. And because we learned our faith this way, it meant that when we failed, when we didn't measure up, we experienced shame. We either experienced the shame of those who knew what we had done, made us a little bit nervous to come back to the group, or we knew ourselves we had, and we experienced personal shame. And we entered the place with our head down. Sometimes it was both. That's just the way it works. Human beings, I don't think there's any denying this, we have decided that if we are really going to go along and get along with folks, really what matters is our performance. And really what we're trying to measure on, how well are you performing? And we can justify anything about ourselves because we know we're trying harder. And if we can't meet the expectations for ourselves, if we can't stop letting ourselves down, if we don't stop letting our group down, then what we do instead is we find someone who we know we can keep one more commandment than they can. After all, human competition is blood sport. And I can feel better about myself so long as I can feel like I'm better than you. I mean, you get how that works? And that's a religious structure and a religious system. That is all religions cultivate that. And it's a shame that somewhere along the way, someone taught us that that's what the Christian faith was like. And they sometimes use the passage just like this. You're not good enough. You don't measure up enough. And then, as if it isn't bad enough, what we say to one another and what we do to one another in that fashion, we get Jesus' own words. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. There it is. Right there. I mean, after all, you do get what he includes the meek and the poor in spirit and those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, that class, that group of marginalized people. They had been put down by the religious elite of the day. And so they love the fact that Jesus has said to them, listen, you're welcome. You're blessed. You're welcomed into the kingdom. And y'all are the salt of the earth and y'all are the light of the world. Now get after it. And then, as if to turn the knife one more degree. And by the way, because now that you're in, you think you're better than you're more righteous then? Don't go back to the old way thinking that if you keep these commandments somehow you've now pleased me. Because guess what? I have set the bar higher. I've bid up your morality. I just have to tell you, if you read that and say to yourself, if I've got to be like that to be in Jesus' in-group, why bother? I mean, if that's what my life's got to look like, listen, I know that's impossible. So why don't I just say, well, it was nice hanging for a while and some great stuff you got going on there, Jesus. And man, what a fantastic teacher. And like those the writer of Hebrews describes, we've been brought right to the brink of the water. We've felt its splash. We've sensed its goodness. But we think, why bother? And we turn away. Not believing the promise that in Jesus we find our rest from all that performing stuff. Because we've so convinced ourselves, because of our natural tendencies, that we've got to outperform each other, be more spiritual, more righteous, more holy than others, that if we can't, why bother? We'll just go do something else. And I think actually we have a heightened awareness of this, don't you? You do know sometimes the sermon is for the preacher. But it really is nice when you're connecting with it too. You know? I mean, think about it, right? Our parallel passages have been in 1 Corinthians. And right over there in 1 Corinthians, you get the very early stages of Christian celebrityhood. Some decided they liked Paul and Apollos and see, you know, that sort of thing. And so they divided in the church. Because after all, now that you have television, someone out there preaches better than I do. Someone teaches in a way that connects you better with anything you'll ever hear Nathan or Brad or myself or anybody else we invite to stand here and say. So celebrity culture really works hard against us, doesn't it? I mean, listen, I know that you measure what you hear against what everybody else tells you they heard where they are. My pastor, you should have heard him today. I'm pretty sure he could preach your pastor under the table. Listen, I've been under the table so long that the idea that I'm in competition with the other pastors even in our community, it's just, that's just ego. But what happens is, because of the time we live in, we're not just hearing about these other Christian teachers as they travel through the region of Asia Minor, for instance. Flip on your TV, grab your phone, you get it. You get whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want. And so what we do is we find those folks who make Mardell's bestseller list or Lifeway's top 10. And we think, man, those folks are really spiritual. I mean, someone will even publish their thoughts. You do know that anybody can publish anything, right? You do know that. But that's the nature of things. Listen, I love Beth Moore, and I'm glad that she's actually turned a corner from what she, some of the things she said even 20 years ago. And I am excited that our ladies really like hearing her, because she's saying some things I think that maybe should have been said even earlier on in her work. Or Ms. Shirer. Or, listen, guys, I don't know what you all read. Men. Never mind. My point, though, is that we live in a culture where it's easy to get swept up in the Christian celebrity, thinking that those people live in such a way that someone's willing to publish their books so that what they have to say is better than anything that you could ever hear anywhere else, and you know nothing about them. Zero. Nada. But you yield to them some sense of authority to speak into your lives because their name's on a book. They speak at a conference. Someone told you how great they were. But you know nothing about them. Zero. In fact, it might surprise some of you to learn that a lot of the books that you read in Christian Kish are not written by the authors whose names bear the book. But they hire someone like me. You laugh. Now, I've not made a bestseller. But I have been asked to write before. You'll never know. I can't tell. But what I'm saying is that the difference of what Jesus is doing here and what we've lapped up is Jesus is saying that what matters is the community in which you find yourself. Antioch, the church in Antioch, wasn't interested in what anybody else had to say, and the reader who was reading was simply connecting the dots for them, and he was wanting them to know that in this Sermon on the Mount, Jesus was doing something to scrap Christian celebrity before it started. We just didn't pay attention. Because really, we have to admit, we know one another so well, many of us, that we know the spiritual depths that we attribute to our favorite author don't show up anywhere in our congregation. At least that's what we think. That's what we think. So enamored are we by those who professionally do that, even pastors, that we think, man, if I could just live like they do. You don't know them. But you do know the person sitting next to you. If you're married to them, I really hope you don't know them. Most of you know at least more than a few people in this room, and they know you. And you know what? What you've learned is not that you are in competition with them, but that you're with them. And that's the sort of community that Jesus believes and preaches that the world needs. So what he does, Jesus pushes us to think beyond performance to intention. Now I want to say that again. Jesus pushes us away from our natural tendency to perform and calls attention to our intent. You've heard it said, but I say to you. And if you read each one of those, for example, you've heard it said, you shall not murder, but I'm telling you, if you're angry with your brother, you're liable to judgment. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I tell you that everyone who looks on a woman with lust has already done it. Jesus is moving away away from our evaluation by performance, and he's saying, what's the intent of your heart? Because what's in you is what will come out of you. What's in you is what will come out of you. You can perform what's not in you. It's easy. We do it weekly. And not at church. Well, although we may. You'll start this charade all over again tomorrow morning when you clock in. You see, in church, we sometimes get swept up into that. And this sermon is to kind of catch our attention. Not my sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, by the way. Is intended to catch our attention. That anytime we face or feel the temptation or the urge to judge one another on our performance, we probably should just return here. We probably just should take it out. The one thing that kept Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the church was the Sermon on the Mount. It was the one place where he could go and say, there's something supposed to be different about our world. There's something supposed to be good about God. It's good news of him being with us in Jesus. You see, what happens is we start thinking our performance is somehow getting God's attention, that he's more happy with us the more righteous we are. That's not what Jesus is saying. If you'll allow me, do you have enough time for about a 60-second footnote? Unplanned? So you know what unplanned could also mean? An unforced error. You know, we have been talking about ordaining additional deacons in our church. And we've inherited a particular tradition that somehow left out the women deacons in the Bible. And so we're afraid to include women as deacons in our church, because we're afraid that somehow that will mark us in a way that we're not performing according to someone's already determined standards for us. But Phoebe was called a deacon, Junia an apostle, Rizpah was celebrated in the Old Testament, Huldah, Deborah, and by the way, women were the first evangelists. They're the ones who told about the resurrection before anybody else did. So it seems ironic that in our day, that we would succumb to the idea that somehow we've moved left by simply honoring what's already found in the text. Now that I've thoroughly upset many of you, let's move on. You see, the reason I point that out is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, when he thought church was about performing, he thought it was about performing. By the way, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German who resisted the Nazis, who didn't believe in a violent response, but yet because of what was going on in his own country, he actually made the decision, conflicted as it was, to participate in an attempt to assassinate Hitler. He was hung just a few days before the end of the war. And here Bonhoeffer, he was trying to find a community who could resist what was going on in his country politically. And so he knew, he had studied, he had read, he had an idea of what that community ought to look like. And the minute he entered that community, the minute he came with his own ideas, he realized that forcing his ideas on other people to perform was actually going to ruin the very community that he thought would be the best place for him. So his vision of that community had to die. So if your vision is the church has got to be a place where performance is A+ all the time, we're always on, then we're expecting more than is possible. And we're saying, really, we don't want to have to practice forgiveness. So if you could just do it better, I wouldn't have to forgive you. Bonhoeffer says, my vision had to die, or I was actually going to kill the community to which I had attached myself to. Jesus is talking to a community of people, a group of people, saying, you are the salt, you are the light, you are what the world needs as an expression of who I am. So Jesus raised the bar so high that the whole community would know, would realize its common need. Let me say that again. Jesus raised the bar so high so that the whole community would realize its common need. Jesus isn't just trying to see if he can't torture us human beings by requesting more of us. That push from performance to intent is to get all of us to the realization that all of us battle our intent. All of us battle our motivations. All of us battle, why do we do what we do? So it leaves us back to the question is, so maybe we should just say, why bother? That's really job killing, by the way, for me, to tell you, why bother? At least you're paying, still paying attention. That's really not what Jesus is saying. The intent and the aim is to for us to recognize that Jesus is our righteousness. That in Christ, what we understand is that our intentions will never measure up. Our performance will never measure up. So there's no need for us to shame one another or shame ourselves. Instead, there's good news that in Christ, Jesus is our righteousness. That is, Jesus has filled up those Ten Commandments, lived them all out, and Jesus has the perfect intention for all of us. So now, like the song we sang, and I wish, I do hope that though you may not like the advanced metrics and the new music, that when we do bring back an old hymn, Come Thou Fount, that you'll capture the line that it's God's grace that we want to bind our hearts that are prone to wonder. Because when we wander outside of grace, all we're entering is shame. When we walk outside of God's grace, we are opening ourselves up to shame. That is, we now move to the place where we think if I perform well and if I get my motivation down right, then I'm somehow going to please God. You just report back to me how that's going for you from time to time. I just might give it a try if you're finding it successful. But I would rather be bound to Jesus and His grace. Because what you don't know about me, I do. And what I don't want you to know about me, you may have already guessed. So, by God's grace in Jesus, this sermon is to say, this is my community. I've invited you into it, and I've made all the preparations. I've fulfilled all the obligations. And now I'm opening up you to be free, to be a new humanity, where you don't have to wonder in shame about whether or not you've performed well enough. You don't have to scrutinize your intention. I've taken care of all that. Now you're set free. Now, the thing that we often do with that is to say, well, I guess that means I can do what I want to. Listen, the heart that is bound or captured by grace is not the sort of heart that says, I'll do what I want to do. If that's the conclusion you draw, then you've not encountered grace. You've just been looking for your loophole. And a loophole it's not. Jesus fills up the law for us so that our participation in the kingdom is not determined by our performance. The consequence of the good news is that in that same message, God is with us. Now listen. Listen, folks, we can get a lot of things wrong. And we do. That's just the nature of our fallible minds. But the one thing we can get right is God's grace. And when we get that right, then we understand and can view the world more clearly, as Jesus did, that He is with us. He's with us when we have performance failure. And He's with us when our intentions are less than honorable. And in that, we find that He's filled up what's lacking in us, And by His grace, we look and say, boy, look what we now can do. I don't think it should be lost on us the way the Apostle Paul interpreted this. The Apostle Paul interpreted the fact that all of us are in the same boat as a means to point out that Jesus is creating a new humanity, breaking down the walls of division that exist between we who are trying to outperform each other and be more altruistic than the others. This new humanity is the church. It's us. And we're just a small part of that. We're not the church. We're just Paul's small part of God's church. And so if Jesus has filled up the law for us, if He has taken care of our intentions, and He's invited us in, know this, that by His Spirit, He's made us able. That about the time you think that I can't live without anger, you can. Not because somehow you've learned the trick. Your mindfulness is all good. Because your mind has been set on Jesus, captured by His grace, so that now you look at another person, you don't have to think, well, how can I be angry at that person? How can I compete with that person? We live together in such a way that we hope that by God's Spirit we are a people who answer the longing of the song, Lord, I need You. Let me explain that. Lord, I need You is a song of recognition that I need someone to be with me. And that's what God calls us to do for others. Be with them in the name of Jesus. Now, that's the community Jesus is shaping and forming. That's what He's calling us to. So, frankly, I'm glad that Jesus raised the bar, up the bid, to make us aware of all of this good grace He's made available to us.